And do you think that we're all panicking unnecessarily?
I don't think we're panicking unnecessarily, but I think there are some very testing propositions lurking behind this very easy slur of post-fact or kind of post-truth environment. So I've certainly seen, and I spent quite a lot of time following on and off the Trump campaign and watching how they responded to the mainstream media in the last year. And you know, I'm just going to raise, because I think there's just a lot of people who sort of feel that post-truth is the big problem. So I'm just going to raise some of the ways that maybe they might see it or things that might be lurking behind it that the liberal press has been, and I'm using liberal here, whether we mean something like The Economist-based sort of free market liberal at its core or perhaps more left-leaning liberal like The New York Times. But I think there's enough continuity there for us to use the word in that sense. I am, after all, in a lecture theatre. I did find it very interesting when the whole idea of what is a post-fact. I mean, to say that there is no such thing as a fact seems a very odd statement, because facts should be, in some sense, verifiable. And yet many people who are now suddenly outraged about there being this thing called post-facts were the first people to say, well, it's all about narratives, isn't it? You know, it's all about, there are various narratives, and there's a colonial narrative or a feminist narrative, or, you know, or they're approaching it from a point of view of ethnic diversity. So actually we've had quite a lot of post-factiness going around in academia and in the media for quite a long time. The days when people thought a fact is just a fact, what if a fact, as Khrushchev used to say, you know, I think that is a very partial view of the way we have perceived facts. I was trying to look up in that last minute, I've just got a last minute essay crisis way, the origin of the phrase, there is no such thing as a fact, there are only interpretations of facts. It's certainly there in my very old dissertation on Christa Wolf. She uses it. But I think it actually goes back to Marx, or it's certainly part of, you know, of that kind of critique. So we could just check ourselves a little bit that we're not just finding post-facts to be outrageous when a rather disturbing man with funny hair who's become president uses the phrase. Someone else, I'm sorry, I think it was Brian, or maybe Charlie, in your introduction, you threw to Brian that it wasn't just about stuff that you don't like, and that really is very important. It's a very hard thing to police oneself. And although, you know, we often think that we police the debate pretty well as readers, as journalists, those at the sharp end of it, in fact, it's very hard to just question whether what you're seeing is what you wanted to see and therefore you're prepared to give it the benefit of the doubt, or whether there is really a problem. I'm thinking of something I was writing about this week about free schools. We're rather like John. I suppose I've generally been on the very sort of supply-side reform in policy. And so at what point do I think, you know, I can see there's some quite bad results. Do I say, this goes to show free school's a really bad idea? No, because then I'd be Polly Toynbee. But I'm not, so I don't. So I look for something else. And then I have to think, well, what's my timeline on revisiting this? Right? Is it 4 years? Is it 5 years? Is enough changing for me to revisit my original conviction that it might be a good idea to free up supply of schools? And at every turn, I'm just, you know, you should always have the monkey on your shoulder, you know. And of course you won't come up with the perfectible truth on that, on Donald Trump or on anything else. But that, I think, is the difference between, if I am to draw a distinction and claim it, some sort of superiority, always dangerous, between what we do and what we're now calling fake news. I think fake news sets out not to even try to look at another point of view. It doesn't really, it thinks it is there to offset another point of view, and therefore it doesn't need to look at it. And that's why it's a very different experience. You feel it straight away, and if you're reading something like Breitbart, which starts from that philosophy, it feels different from reading another quite right-wing site that is based, at least basing its arguments, in observable facts, data, and things that the reporters have seen, or on the left to go the other way. Having said that, I think it's quite easy to see where that bridge exists, you know, from that position of I just happen to be selecting my facts on the left to I'm now in a completely post-facty left-wing world, because actually these positions do tend to meet round the back. You find yourself only looking for the things which seem to back up your case, and verifiability, to use a horrible big American word, which I think probably, you know, is a good one in its sense, doesn't really exist anymore. I remember talking at one point on the Trump campaign to the way that they looked at things like numbers at rallies, which I should put a bit more work into looking back anyway. This was a point at which this argument was bubbling up, and When you say it here, and when Charlie did his funny intro, we all go, oh, yeah, I know. Now let's go into the heads of people around Trump. Go into the heads of someone like Kellyanne Conway, a brilliant Republican pollster who did some of the best work on polling on women and strategy on women. And indeed, you know, that comes, I think, not only from those of us who followed her work, but from the very good book she did with Celinda Lake, another brilliant pollster who happens to be a stonking great Democrat. So Kellyanne Conway takes up with Trump, decides she's going to help Trump get elected, and she does. She's campaign manager, she saves a pretty ropey campaign, and off they go, and it works out well. And her take on how numbers and crowds were reported. Yeah, I just took this note. It's a little bit old, but it's an interesting one. That she says, he doesn't feel he was understood or given a chance. And well, her view is that reporters come to rallies to do down the people at the rallies, to say they're pretty thick, blue collar, partly meaning just not very well educated, also kind of with a sort of undertone of a bit thick. And that the idea that you would come to a Trump rally and just stand back and say, all right, what's he really saying here? What does it reflect? Is there any way my liberal preconceptions are challenged? Her view was that that hardly ever happened, if ever, in the liberal American media. And I think she has a point. I really do. And I think the difficulty is, sorry, I'll hand over now. I'm sure some of this will wash back around again. To the difficulty of what do you let the monkey on your shoulder say to you? When should it say, he might have a point about that? And it's very difficult, because there is so much that is very bad, dangerous, narcissistic, and thoroughly reprehensible about Donald Trump, just to be clear where I'm coming from, that to sort of go, oh, yeah, well, he has got a bit of a point about infrastructure. Yeah. Seems, some people say that's normalising Trump. But again, you see, I worry about that language. I think that normalising sort of meta-narrative is the one that stops you wanting to get curious about what's in front of you. And as where the old, gritty old mainstream, much derided media in which John and I eke out our last days, or whether you're the fantastic new startups, you know, here, some reflected on the panel and about 12 more of you out there, if you're not curious and you don't keep listening to that other voice, then I think you will still be doing a very flawed journalism, no matter how judgy the platform and how many gazillions of hits you might get.
I mean, I take your point about how journalism should be more, what's the word, humble or something.
Testing, yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
But you obviously work for a wonderful magazine, which is actually fantastic online, terrific at social media and so on. So it's not some sort of fusty place, but it is has an audience and a worldview that's very much of a sort of elite. And you mentioned in passing that, oops, actually President Trump may not be exactly what you would want, and he may actually cause quite a lot of harm. Do you think there's a danger, though, that with your sort of meta-relativism there, I think that's right, or something,
I don't know how many degrees.
That it's too easy, some would be saying, no, you should be much more aggressive and critical, not just about his policies, but about what he is doing, that here is somebody who is, you know, still persisting with this myth that there was voter fraud, for example.
Well, he isn't, actually. I mean, I think that's what he does, is he throws these things up and throws them back down again, and then journalists who are trained, again, to sort of spot the bits that they're, he's mentioning how quickly voter fraud disappeared when he won 90 years ago. Having said that, I've seen that happen quite a bit, and it's amazing how everyone remembers the hanging chads of their own side. So, no, but should you be more aggressive? Just to answer that, if I could, just to speed it along a bit. I mean, I don't think anyone could say that The Economist has been sort of not forthright in what it said about Trump. We think he's a liability. But we were asked tonight to sort of go a little bit behind the cover stories, and so, because no one's ever going to tweet this, so I'm going behind the I'm going behind that a bit and saying I don't know, and I'm speaking perhaps a bit more for myself here, how much just treating it with aggression is going to do any good. Who are you enlightening that you haven't enlightened before, who you're reaching that you haven't before? I do think it is genuinely difficult. A colleague said, of covering a certain kind of event that he'd witnessed. It was a bit like the Weimar Republic, you know, where did you stop just saying, oh, this is very interesting, you know, you've got all these parties and it's fragmenting, and when did you go, ah? And but I think going, ah, is there are moments to do that, and there's certainly statements that Trump has made that merited that response. But as I wrote in the Standard, my sort of column home tonight, you know, I'm an engager, and I think, for instance, if you take to cut to brass tacks, if you really only want to go into the sort of finger-pointing, you are wrong, but you somehow got elected, then you perhaps, is Theresa May, you wouldn't go meet Donald Trump in week one. I think there are so many other interests and arguments at stake here that it would be downright irresponsible for a British Prime Minister not to meet the President of the United States. So I wouldn't confuse having a buried in view of someone and making strong arguments against them and sending out strong warning signals about what this could mean for America, for its economy, for other economies that depend on it, for wider world and the security of the wider world, and the absolutely foolhardy treatment of Russia and Vladimir Putin and all that risks. But again, I have to keep a bit of the mind open for what is going on, what should I be curious about, and what am I missing? If not, I might as well just, you know, go on the march with a placard, and that's not journalism. It's a completely valid thing to do, but it's not journalism.